Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksicles, what the fuckadelics, and what the fuckhawks? Like it just came out of me. Don't know where from, but that's what happened. Welcome to the show. I am Mark Maron. Thank you for being here. And yes, I am a little sick. I am battling something for a change. I did not pace myself well. I got done with the shoot, and I scheduled, months ago, I scheduled work right away because I'm a fucking idiot. So now I'm worn out and beat up. I haven't even been able to sleep right since we stopped the insane schedule of shooting. And then I got some sort of heinous cold, and now I'm off to Rochester as we speak. I'll be at the Comedy Club in Webster, New York, in the Rochester area if you want to come. I'll be doing four shows there, and I will be battling a cold during those shows. And reacquainting myself with the hour I've been doing before I started shooting, and probably having some sort of mild meltdowns during each show, which is a signature hook of mine when I travel on the road. Which show is Maron going to lose it, and is he going to pull it around? That's the name of my next CD. Is he going to pull it around? I don't know. Could take 25 years. I jest, kinda. I'm jesting a bit. Perhaps not. I think it's going to be a good weekend. I'm excited to get back into the trenches. And of course, when I go, it looks like it's going to be raining, maybe snowing. And then I'm thinking about going down to New York City for a couple days, do some business, and it's probably going to be raining and snowing there because it's been that way ever since, every time I've gone there. Now, look, I'm not complaining. I know a lot of you guys have been through a lot of stuff through the winter. It's been difficult for you. Has not been as difficult for me out here in the beautiful weather of Los Angeles. But I do like it to be nice when I travel to the Big Apple. Anywho, did I just say that? I'm embarrassed. Anyway, today on the show, John Doe of the band X, who I was thrilled to talk to. Quite a history. What a fucking amazing band that was. He'll be performing this weekend in the LA area on Saturday. He's at the First Unitarian Church in Los Angeles, along with Exene of X. And Robin Hitchcock, another genius, been on this show. You can also see the three of them Sunday in Solana Beach at Belly Up. Man, that's good shit, man. That is some good rock and roll there, or whatever they'll be doing. Some form of it. It takes many forms to rock and roll. All right, relax, man, relax. What else is happening on the personal front? Well, yeah, I'm a little sick. I'm eating a lot of oranges. I got this thing in my mouth that I'm not going to freak out about because I've had it before. And I don't know anybody else who gets them, which makes me embarrassed to talk about it, which means I'm going to fucking talk about it. I'm going to fucking talk about it with you. That's right, you. Maybe someone can identify with me. I've never felt so alone in a weird ailment than these things that happen inside of my mouth. What happens inside of my mouth is sometimes if I bite my lip too much, or I bit my lip in one spot a few times, it got all fucked up. But then what happens is somehow or another, one of the thousands of salivary glands you have in your mouth, one of mine will get clogged or crushed and create what looks to be a blister, but it's not. It's a clogged salivary gland. And that means I have to go to an oral surgeon and have it removed, taken out of my mouth. Now, I've talked about this with people and they're like, what the fuck? And I'm like, no, doesn't this happen to you? No, it doesn't. So if someone out there has had this, where they get the little little balloon of a clogged salivary gland in their mouth that they've had to have surgically removed, I would like to know so I don't feel alone in the world. Could you do that for me? Or else I just feel like some freak. I made an appointment to get it taken out, and I asked the woman, I said, is this a common thing? And she's like, well, it's not that common, but people it happens to, it happens to. I'm like, that was not helpful at all. Oh, here's some interesting business. I got a piece of written mail and a CD in the mail. Hello, Mark. I lived in blah, 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 blah before you. That was my address that I didn't read. Like, that matters. To cut to the chase, my wife just brought home your book, Attempting Normal, from the library, and we were laughing at your description of the garage. And then in parentheses, it says, you should have seen it when we bought the place. So I thought I'd send along this CD that I recorded in there. Broken concrete is hard to set up drums on, but we did. That's right. Before I put this temporary floor in, it was all shattered concrete. Not sure if it's your kind of thing, but thought you'd dig some history. My buddy Richie Hayward from Little Feet recorded with me in that garage. Hope all is great in Highland Park. Your book is great. Keep on keeping on. I knew he was a musician, but I didn't know this album, Wildflowers, by Connie Price and the Keystones, was recorded in this garage. And it must have been something because there's like a lot of dudes in this band. There's horn players and everything. And that happened in here, and I didn't even know it. And the dude from Little Feet was in here jamming too. In this garage! So it's been a magical place before. I listened to the record. It's really good. Really good. The guy who is behind me has this open field in the back, and he just randomly starts projects. Just mysteriously sawing things, making piles of stuff, planting things. It's interesting. I wish I had a hobby field. That's what I need. I need a hobby field. You guys, I got to be honest with you. One of these days, I'm going to disappear into the wilderness. I think I've talked about this before. I'm going to Jeremiah Johnson my life. Just head out with a heavy jacket of furs and a beard and find the open wilderness. Do some trapping. Perhaps some... What is happening? What is happening? Why is that happening? I can't... What? Why is it coming through my computer? What is going on? When did the phone start coming through the computer? My God. That was jarring. The band X is one of the great LA bands. It's one of the great... I guess you would definitely call them a punk band. But LA punk, American punk, fucking rock and roll. X was a great fucking band. And John Doe is an amazing musician and songwriter. And he's here with us today. And we're going to talk to him right now.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Ow.
You lived in Mount Washington with Exene in the 80s.
Yes.
Now, but it was pretty, it was sort of nice, it was nice up there, right?
Oh, it's, yeah, it was nice. But I mean, Highland Park was nice.
But I mean, up there, it feels like when I go up to Mount Washington, the only thing that scares me is like, there's only one road down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
to stay up top at the self-realization center.
Oh, that, yeah, that place.
Watch it all burn.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, well, that was a sanitarium.
Where it was?
Yeah.
That place up
in... It was in like the place up at the top of Mount Washington was like a dryout center for all the big shit movie stars.
No kidding. Back in the day.
Yeah, like in the 20s.
So we're going to hide them up there, and they won't be able to get off the hill.
Right.
And just wait till they get better.
Wait till they get better from there.
And who knew that would become one of the biggest businesses in the country?
Yeah.
The drying out business. So you lived up there, so you know this area.
Avenue 45.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now somebody else that knew us, Sean Wheeler from Sean and Xander.
Yeah.
You know, they're a folk duo.
Yeah.
And Sean was in the throw rag and stuff like that. Anyway, he was doing a recording next door to the old house. And it's like, hey, I cut some of the palm fronds on that tree. That's why it looks so freaking good. Watch out for the castor beans. They'll poison you. They'll kill you.
You know the place.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry I was so hopped up when he came in. You know, I got... I don't know how to handle new equipment. I felt like I was very uncool when you first checked in. I'm like, I got a new guitar.
That's, you know, I bought a piano. It cost $200. It was like $100 for the piano and $75 to deliver it.
Where do you live now?
I live on in the East Bay, Richmond.
Oh, up north. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I haven't lived in L.A. forever. I mean,
did you run away from L.A.?
I had to leave Los Angeles. No, I didn't run away. I just like at the point, you know, I worked in with X for years and years, and then I did two movies like pretty close together.
Yeah.
Great Balls of Fire and Roadhouse. And
right.
It's like I can buy a house now.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. I can't buy a house in L.A. because it was 1986 or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was a top of another
boom.
Real estate boom. Yeah. And so, and I didn't, I was done, you know, I was done with it. And
fried.
You know, yeah. Just, it was no longer inspiring. And so my wife at the time and I moved up to the Grapevine.
But you're still friends with Exene?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
We're partners.
That's great.
It is great.
And do you have kids?
Through thick and thin.
Do you have kids with both of them?
No. No, Exene and I never had kids, but I have three daughters that are just awesome. And it's, but, you know, I qualify that.
Yeah.
So, like, kids are wonderful.
Yeah.
But everybody shouldn't have them. And it doesn't complete your life and all that other bullshit that.
I haven't
especially,
had them.
Well, especially new parents that start going all goo-goo about, you know, and maybe I'm just too selfish. I don't know.
How old were you when you had your first kid?
Oh, older, like 34.
Right, but not 50. Like, I still haven't had one yet. And there's still part of me that's sort of like, no, maybe I can.
Yeah, maybe you could.
Maybe I could.
I've been in a relationship with my current sweetheart for 7 years. We've known each other for like 13.
Yeah.
And we had a conversation several years ago that luckily only lasted about a couple days, you know, off and on. And it's like, and she said, I had a pretty rough childhood and it's fine with me. She's several years younger than me, which is
oh, so
great.
This is the third one.
Third long-term, yes.
Okay, so you had the three kids with the one in between.
Yes.
Okay, I got it. So she's good.
Yeah, she's fine. I actually just saw her last night at a dance recital in Santa Cruz. My youngest daughter was part of a dance.
Oh, that's
exciting. Program.
She's going to Santa Cruz?
She just finished there, yeah.
That's
UC Santa Cruz.
Trippy school, man.
It's a great school.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
It's beautiful down there. It's a little wild vibe in Santa Cruz.
The town is wild.
Yes. Yes.
The town is
like what's going on?
Wide open.
Man? Yeah, wide open. That's
that's what they used to call it, like back in the, you know, cowpuncher days.
Oh, that place is wide open. But on a psychic level.
I think you can get whatever you want in Santa Cruz.
Exactly.
Pretty much whatever you want.
But on some level, you've got to, these days, or have these moments where you're like, holy shit, you know, I survived.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, I can't imagine.
I'm so grateful.
Whatever happened, what was it, in the late 70s, early 80s in this city, was crazy, man. I mean, a lot of people went down.
Yeah, like during the time and then not. So, I mean, there's a song that I play called Ready, and it's kind of a tribute to Jeffrey Lee Pierce and
I was going
to
ask you about that
Darby
guy.
and Elliot Smith. I was kind of friends with him, too, and it's I will introduce it live and say, you know, I'm not wishing ill will to many people, but all the Eagles are still alive. So are Fleetwood Mac, except for the good ones. And, you know, is it just better health care, you know? Because, like, there's a lot of fucking punk rockers that are dead. Sad and scary.
But do you come up with an answer for that?
No, I think it's better health care.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they got rich and they could take care of themselves.
But also it seemed that, like, at the time, like, I was listening to the first 4X records, you know, over the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. And I listened to Fire Love. I listened to the Gun Club still. Yeah. And
it's a great record.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But, like, I think the answer is that, you know, what was at stake for you guys, you know, mm-hmm. what you were chasing was different. It seemed like these studio musicians and these guys that evolved into like Fleetwood Mac or say the Eagles, they were looking to live large.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like the hunger during that punk scene was not about that.
No, it wasn't.
It was about pushing the fucking envelope.
I think embarking on writing a book.
Okay.
I am. This guy, Tom DeSavia, a friend of mine and I are going to work on a book and we're going to do a LA punk rock history book.
Right.
But we're going to get Exene and Keith Morris and a bunch of other people who were there Alice Bag and Terry Graham from Gun Club and all these people, Chris D from the Flesh Eaters. We're going to get each of them to write a chapter. I've written a couple. Tom's going to do some intro, and cause he's a publisher guy. But it was a fan, like a 15, 16-year-old, that it scared the shit out of him.
But they
meant, like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And then, but I'm hooked.
Right. You meant
oh my God. This is, oh fuck. They've got razor blades in their boots or something, you know.
And it's fast.
Yeah.
But where'd you come from originally?
Baltimore.
That's where you grew up?
Pretty much from third grade on. My dad was a librarian.
Really?
Yeah. A very ambitious librarian. So.
What does that mean?
It means he ended up being like a big administrator. He was the head of Brooklyn Public Library.
So, oh, okay.
For at the end of his life.
And you have a big family? You come from a big family?
No, just one brother. Both my folks are dead. And
what's the real name?
Oh, it's Czech.
It's a Czech name?
It's a Czech name, and it's Dukach, and it's spelled all backwards. But then I changed it to my mom's maiden name, so my kids wouldn't have to suffer for my sins. Yeah. And at least my mom's maiden name is Danish, and so it's at least phonetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's online if people need to know, but
yeah.
Sometimes they'll say it's Hitler, but I didn't think it would do so good in the entertainment business.
It might have been great for punk rock though.
Yeah, I know.
So what compelled you to come out here? Did you when did you leave Baltimore?
The end of 76.
How old were you?
23.
Were you already playing back there?
Oh yeah. Played in bar bands, played like the band and Neil Young songs and
so that
Rolling
was always
Stone
your thing.
Songs. And, yeah. Well,
like catalog.
And I wrote poetry. I went to Antioch College in Baltimore, which was just totally hilarious.
Yeah. All the way through?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, I quit. I went to George Washington for a year, then I quit for like a year and a half and put on aluminum siding and roofing and all kinds of lovely things.
Going to be a working man for a little while?
I was, and then I thought, this sucks.
Yeah?
This is terrible.
Yeah.
No, I just wasn't interested, and I wanted to play, and I played music, you know.
What was the degree in?
Poetry and American literature.
So that was your thing?
That was my thing. I ran a poetry reading series in Baltimore called The Poetry Project. I'm realizing now that I was seeing it in with a little bit longer view. I was seeing it as like, no, then.
Really?
And I think that the people that the other people like Darby and the other people that were in these in a lot of bands that were just like, fucking teenage runaways, they were just in it for the kicks and just like, let's tear this shit up.
Right.
And let's just see what happens. And I don't give a flying fuck about anything. And I didn't, in a rebellious, like, I'm going to stick it to the man, or I don't like this whole corporate rock thing that's going on, and there's too much money, and there's too much extravagance, and
everyone. This was what you thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all deteriorated into bullshit. I saw Talking Heads in New York, and I saw the Heartbreakers, because my folks lived in Brooklyn.
Oh, my God. That must have been awesome.
It was great.
Were they on it?
Oh, hell yeah.
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 The Heartbreakers were such a game changer for everyone, it seemed.
Yeah. That was when Richard Hell was still in them. But I realized that I was so sick of the East Coast.
Yeah.
I mean, I love John Waters.
Right.
And he and I were, kind of acquaintances then.
How would you know him?
Just from hanging out in the bars
in Baltimore?
In Fells Point, yeah.
Yeah.
Fells Point now is all full of yuppies and frat boys and bullshit like that. But then it was just, Edie and Mink Stole and Mary Vivian Pierce and David Lockery and all the, people that were, the bums that would come in there and like, it was all stories. I'm positive there was one bum that used to masturbate while we played.
Oh, yeah.
He'd stand over in the corner and he'd have this big long raincoat on and sort of bounce around. And it's like, there's Johnny. He's doing his thing. I don't want to know what that thing is. It's like in San Francisco. Like, don't look over. Just keep walking. There's nothing to see there. Just keep walking. But I was just sick to death of the weather and the people. And, when you get too many ghosts and too many, like, oh, I remember that bad time I had there. And, oh, that's this, East Coast is can be really, especially Baltimore. It's like the good part of it was you couldn't put on any airs.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, wait a minute. Are you from Balmer?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
Yo, yeah, you're fucking nobody.
Yeah.
You're fucking nobody because you're from Balmer.
Yeah.
and then... You know, so...
So you got
that
run
was
out
great.
By ghosts.
No, yeah, but that was great because people just did art for art's sake. They didn't... They couldn't capitalize. They couldn't, you know...
Yeah, the point being is that you didn't... You wanted to live.
I want... Yes, I did. I think it's a very nice thing. The living thing is the nice thing.
And there were definitely guys back then that were gunning for it.
But I think I had a... I had an idea that this was... That this was an extension of... The beatniks and the psychedelic era and the and you know, like some sort of, it was a extension of some kind of art.
Punk was,
yeah, not high art, but art like Andy Warhol and
right oral
John
tradition.
Waters, yeah. and stuff, you know, it was like popular art, and it's like I think the you know Ramones and all of us, we wanted to be famous,
right.
We wanted to be popular.
But so like, but go
and then the Sex Pistols came in and fucked it all up for everybody.
They kind of did, right?
In some ways.
I listened to that record the other day. It's okay.
It's a good record.
Yeah.
The sounds are great.
But
Steve Jones is a kick-ass guitar player.
Yeah, but the fashion thing kind of...
That was it, and also pissing off people and saying to the press... We never told the press to fuck off.
Right.
You know, and I think the Pistols and some other bands said, you know, oh, fuck off, all you. And it's like, the powers that be said, okay, fine.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, fuck you.
Yeah, good
luck. You're going nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there was the, you know, the hourglass of
sure.
art and then the media and yeah. then the people. You
Have
had
fun
to get
with your
through.
One record.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Surviving the anyway. One record. Anyway. No, but I think that's interesting. Although, you know, Dylan was kind of, you know, standoffish and pricky with the press. And
true.
You know, there was definitely, you know, a tradition to it.
True.
But he was Dylan.
Yeah, he could get away with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he had more than one record in him.
Yeah.
So
somebody said, you know, if you hear some words or some lyrics or you get an idea for a song at 2:30 in the morning, you better get up and write it down, because if it doesn't, by default it goes to Bob Dylan. That was a great one.
That's great. There's just lyrics running around the ether.
Exactly.
They're gonna run.
Oh well, he doesn't want it. Better give it to Uncle Bob.
I tried to wake you up, man. but seriously, I don't think it's boring. I think, like, you know what you were, you know, because I mean, I used to do. I wrote poetry. I edited the Literary Journal in college. I was. Nice. I believe in it.
Yeah.
And I can still read it, and I love it, and I think that there's sort of like, you know, there's a lot of life equations that works out in your songs and also in poetry. So, like, mm-hmm. who were you going to say? What was who was the guy you were into at the beginning that kind of blew your mind?
I like John Ashbery.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the and Frank O'Hara.
Oh
and,
yeah.
You know, of course, Sylvia Plath and Denise Levertov and Diane Wachowski. And I mean, I came to L.A. mostly because I was sick of the East Coast, but also because I loved the movies and the whole Hollywood. And as soon as I saw Hollywood was in a, like, in the state of Tennessee Williams decay,
yeah,
you know, the Hollywood sign, the O had fallen down.
It was broken at that point.
It was falling down. It's yeah. like nobody had the civic pride to put the motherfucker up. And it's like, this is perfect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, oh, by the way, there's no live music. That's interesting.
There wasn't?
Not really.
Yeah, because what, there was just a few clubs that were kind
disco,
of tired? Oh, it was
a lot of
that's
disco.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was all gone? So it was the mid-70s. It. Right.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Whiskey, you know, they would have cover bands, and Van Halen was playing around a little bit.
Yeah.
And early on I saw Cheap Trick at the Starwood.
In 76, 77?
Yeah, 76.
They were good. Cheap Trick was good.
It was awesome.
So you come out here with just sort of this romantic idea of what Hollywood was, and were you looking for the decay, or were you thinking that it would be glamorous?
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Where's the darkness?
Don't be silly, Mark. I knew where my bread was buttered.
Had you published any poems at that point?
Yeah, and a couple, like, you know, literary magazines.
And was that satisfying for you or not? I mean, was
no,
it
really? No, not really.
It's not, right?
No, it wasn't.
It's so insulated, the world that loves that stuff.
Yeah, but there was a lot of DC poets, a lot of, you know, they were very much into entertaining, very much the spoken word and you know, writing stuff that was guaranteed to get a laugh.
Right.
Guaranteed to get a reaction out of the audience. Tim Dugos was one of them, and Terry Winch, and Terry's gone on to do some other books and play in an Irish band. And I mean, it was kind of like in 73, 74, it was like, you know, along with Patti Smith.
Yeah.
I'll give her that. I'll give her due there. You know, it was like a performance thing.
Right.
And it was, you know, even though her stuff wasn't funny, I mean, there was a lot of people that was, that the stuff was, you know, ironic and like talking right. about your parents and,
sure.
and you know, all this strange
and
stuff.
And were you doing that?
A little bit. Yeah, I tried to.
In D.C.?
In Baltimore and D.C., yeah.
And when, in terms of playing in the band, you were just, you were playing guitar and singing from what age, really?
No, I started on playing bass.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I learned, so I took piano lessons like everybody.
Yeah.
Or a lot of people. And then I thought, oh, well, that's only got four strings. That must be easier.
It is a little bit.
A little. A lot.
Yeah.
That's why bass players can, you know, carry on a conversation and some guitar players can't.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, just lay back.
It's like sitting in your room figuring out that. That's why. Yeah, exactly.
I'm done. I got it. I got it. So, but were you singing at that time?
Yeah. Yeah. I sang from when I was young.
And that kind of music, though, so what was it in terms of musically? Was it seeing somebody like the Heartbreakers that made you realize, like, holy fuck, you know, I got to get out of this cover band. Something's got to change.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was just done. I was done with the
with
whole,
Baltimore cover
the
band
whole thing. The
poetry. The,
yeah. Even though we were, I was writing songs. This guy and I were writing songs together and stuff. And
what happened to that guy?
He moved back, and then he ended up in Austin. I kept touch with him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him a few years ago, and he's actually working for a natural foods company. He's really high up in this Annie's.
Oh yeah,
something or other. Annie's oh, frozen.
Yeah. Yes.
Frozen.
Oh yeah, I know that. Don't they make salad dressings and shit?
I think they make everything.
Yeah,
They're really big.
It's interesting what people end up doing when they live,
yeah.
isn't it? Yeah. how it goes for other people.
I think he still made music, but yeah, it was the I did have some stars in my eyes because of, you know. Well, Charles Bukowski, he's an idiot.
Yeah.
He seems to get through. You know?
And he was around when you came out here.
Oh, yeah. I never met him.
You never sought him out?
I tried to, but he was, you know, he had already moved down to San Pedro or was in the process. He had hooked up with his wife of many years, Linda,
yeah.
at that point. The interesting thing with him is that I ended up moving into a house that he had spent some time in.
Right.
There was a big drawing on this in the kitchen,
yeah.
on a 4x8 sheet of plywood,
yeah.
with his little funny, like James Thurber kind of drawings and little cartoon bubbles and stuff like that. And the lady who was the landlord next door, she was like a museum curator. She worked for a museum or something like that. So I said, look, we're going to take this thing out and put in a nursery,
yeah.
in what was the laundry room.
Right. You
know, it was like half the size of, a quarter of the size of the studio.
Yeah.
So I got a P.O. box for Charles Bukowski, and I said, look, you, there's this, and the address is in one of his books, 2347 Duane Street, in one of his early poetry books. That was the title of one of the poems.
Right.
So I thought, oh, well, this is definitely his, because it's a book at the bottom. And
yeah.
So I said, look, if you want this, be happy to figure out a way to get it to you. I don't, you know, but I'm going to take it down.
Yeah.
And he goes, I have no idea what you're, he writes back, I have no idea what you're talking about. I've never been in that place. You can chop it up for firewood as far as I'm concerned. Just a bunch of like typical Bukowski kind of like, go fuck yourself stuff, right?
Yeah.
Which was perfect. I still have the letter. It was like, that was, oh, it warms my heart. You're such a prick. And then at the very end, that he signs it, and at the very end, P.S., my wife says you have a good band. So Linda's like standing over him, like tapping her foot, going, you better tell him then. So I gave it to the landlord, who, you know, gave it to some museum, and somewhere it's rotting.
But yeah, yeah.
I didn't want it, you know. It was like,
so between Bukowski and the Heartbreakers, that's what set you up to move to Los Angeles?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Why
and,
not?
And what'd you come out here with? Anything?
A truck.
Yeah, Ford,
yeah.
Chevy.
International. An international travel all.
Uh huh.
I was a part of the Suburban, you know, group before the Suburbans were cool or not cool.
So all your shit was in there?
All my shit was in there. And then I bought a bed and a table and a thing, and I moved to Venice, and then I moved like six other places.
When did you meet Exim?
Early on, like I think it was I moved in on Halloween. I left on Halloween, which I thought was good. I was
left,
like,
Baltimore?
Yeah.
It means something.
I'm going to leave this you know, ghosty town for on Halloween. And then I met her probably in, like, within a couple of weeks at a writing workshop. the Venice Poetry Workshop, which still goes on at the Venice Jail, the old Venice Jail.
So you, right when you got here, had you signed up before you left Baltimore?
No.
Oh, no?
I just looked around. I thought, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, I got to, you know, find some people to hang out with, so... And she had a job there through a like a government program. She was learning to typeset.
Mm-hmm.
and they gave her an
apartment. Lucky she has that skill, I guess. Yeah. Right. That's one of those ones that went away.
Yeah.
The necessity of it.
But it was, you know, I was like, wow, this is, you know, she actually got a job. And then she was nice. And then the people at Beyond Baroque, which is still going, people can go down and write, you know, read their work.
Yeah.
And get it critiqued and, you know, support it or not. And they gave her a place to live up above the small press library. And it had moved. It was in a different place than it is now.
Had she come, but she, did she grow up here or she came from another place?
Came from Florida.
Oh, okay.
But she had only been here maybe 8 months.
What was her dream?
To get the hell out of Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was living in Tallahassee, oof, which is like Georgia.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
It's like the, it's not good.
Yeah.
Not good, Florida.
And you guys just hit it off right away?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's very alluring and still is. She's got a mind that is, like, just incredible. And,
yeah.
And she's crazy and sweet and, you know, she was a quintessential, she is, more so than, quintessential lead singer.
Yeah.
Lots of demons.
Right.
Just lots of desire for, not just for fame, not at all for fame, just desire to hold that big flag and say, come on,
yeah,
here we go.
Yeah,
but at the same time very reticent, you know, so a lot of
did,
yeah,
you, and did you need somebody like that?
Sure.
At that time,
I can be a front person, but I'm much happier working with other people.
So how did the band develop? When did you pick up the guitar? When did you guys start doing that?
Well, I met Billy through a recycler ad. There's a paper, free paper, or a paper called $1.25.
Billy Zoom.
Billy Zoom.
Yeah.
I met him early on, too, within the first 2 months.
You were looking to put a band together immediately?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I actually auditioned for a band called The Pop.
Yeah,
which had a song or two, or a record or two,
mm-hmm,
along with the Motels. They I think they were like the precursor, like with the Runaways and the Pop and the Motels. But Billy and I, there was a thing called the Recycler, and there were a lot of personal ads and a lot of ads for musicians, and then also, you know, refrigerators, TVs, and yeah, car parts and things,
sure,
like that. And it came out every Thursday, and everybody would go to the thing, you know, and like look it up. And I called his number, he called mine. There were no answering machines or anything like that because it was 1976, and he had a note on his bulletin board to call John Doe, and but he and I worked together for a little while before Exene came in to sing.
Right.
Exene and I were just friends, and I thought her poetry was incredibly vital and simple, and she had no background in like studied poetry.
Right.
She just wrote.
Right.
And there was a couple songs, one of them, I'm Coming Over, that she, it was a song, clearly.
Yeah.
You know, and she kind of sang it to me. And I said, well, I'd like to do that in this band that I'm trying to put together. And she goes, so, I don't think so. I said, well, what do you mean? And later on, she said, well, that was the only thing that someone else thought was of value.
Mm-hmm.
So why in the hell would I give it away? Why the hell would I let him do it?
Yeah.
That's a stupid idea. So then, you know, Billy thought, oh, I found a bass player that seems pretty good, and now his girlfriend wants to get in the band.
Oh, that was his, yeah. That's
which we weren't actually boyfriend-girlfriend at that point.
But anyway, when you say the Motels and the Runaways were the precursors, what do you mean?
I mean that they were kind of the bridge between glam rock,
right?
And because they were putting on shows of their own.
Yeah,
the Dogs was another band, and I think they had a big PA system, and that eventually became a huge company. They were starting to do. They were independently putting on shows,
right?
So
in the middle of this like horrible disco period,
right? A little before the mask started,
right?
And and then, you know, 76, 75, 76, it all started just like all these people were around and like, yeah, you don't like the music, but, you know, you don't like Peter Frampton? Good, I'm in.
Yeah.
You don't like Linda Ronstadt? Good, me too.
Good. That was the enemy. Disco pretty and much. Brampton.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I get it. So all right. So you Eggstein's not in yet. You talk with Billy, and what kind of songs are you playing? Because he's like, you know, he's kind of heavy duty
rockabilly.
Yeah.
We were doing. We were just kind of like feeling each other's sensibilities out. You know, kind of like we're doing Blue Suede Shoes and Honey Don't and You Really Got a Hold on Me and you know, just some oldie songs.
Yeah.
You know, just to see how we like playing together. And I was trying to, you know, put in some like Velvet Underground into the oldies, sure, thing. You know, instead of doing a shuffle, keep it like straight eighths.
You like the Velvets?
Oh, yeah.
Love them, right?
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah.
Live in 69 changed my life.
Yeah.
That was the first one I heard. It was weird because that's how I came into them.
My older brother had the Andy brother. Warhol one. The older brother.
Oh, so essential.
And I was thinking, who is this man?
Yeah.
And why is he waiting for him? whatever.
It sounds a little urgent.
Yeah, yeah.
Guess you'll find out later.
I guess I'll find out later. Boy, did I. Yeah. But we were pretty good. I mean, we dabbled. We did our fair share. We tried it out. But
oh, yeah.
We didn't get hooked. Uh-huh. Not like, you know, Rick Wilder from the Mau Maus or Darby or any of the
hardcore. Mean back when you were here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people got strung out though, man.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It's king heroin.
Yeah. What was your thing? What was your drug?
More speed than
I
graduated to cocaine and it's like that was the beginning of the end. It's like, "Oh, this is terrible."
Oh, it's
took
so,
a while. It took a long
it took a long time. A
couple of 3 years, of, you know, back and forth.
But coke, like for me, coke was always sort of like speed, though I didn't do it a lot, seemed a lot more economical.
Totally, and you could actually create a government
in your house
in that one night. Whereas cocaine, it never was enough.
You just chased it, man. It's just like, where do we get more of that? That was where your energy went. Yeah. All right, you're gonna need some more. Speed, you're up for 3 days. It's got big plans.
Yeah. Well, we were lucky too. I mean, I was anyway. Is it? And I include Exene in this. If we did some, it would be like after it was done. You know, you'd be up for 18, 20, 24 hours, something like that. And you were, whew, boy, that was rough. Let's go to sleep. Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's go to sleep.
Yeah.
We did.
Right, for a day or two.
Yeah, it's like, rather than, but it was a good time. Yes, it was a great time.
But that was back when it was just like horrible yellow biker crank, right?
Yeah.
Like that weird smell of shit. Yeah.
At least it was made out of, you know, contact pills or you know, acetaminophen.
Sudafeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least it wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So, but before you get into all that, so once you guys figure out, you and Zoom figure out that you can groove together with the oldies,
mm-hmm.
how does it evolve into, like, how does Exene get involved? Where do you find the drummer? And what are those, what is it, gig starts happening?
77. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was pretty soon, like the middle of 77.
Yeah.
We went through a bunch of different drummers. KK Barrett from the Screamers played drums with us, and he's a big, you know, movie set designer. And
oh, really? That's where he ended up?
Yeah.
It's wild,
he did
man.
Good. He did real good. I mean, he does, you know, some big shit like Coen Brothers and stuff
That.
I don't know if he does that, but other big time indie movies. KK Barrett played drums with us for a while. Another guy named Mick from Boston, and his dad got sick and he had to go back home. And then I saw DJ Bonebreak playing with the Eyes. And he had a big parade snare, which are, you know, like 18 inches or 12 inches deep.
Right.
And they're all silver. And I thought, God, this is huge. And, but DJ's just a great drummer. And, I called up Billy from the payphone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The payphone. When they had him. Yeah,
the payphone at the Mask.
Yeah.
They had a payphone downstairs in the basement of the Mask. Somehow
remember
Brandon.
Payphones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're still around.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. You don't want to touch them, though. No. There's one of them.
You have to consider who's using them.
Yeah, that'd be in pretty bad shape.
Yeah. Anyway, there was somehow Brendan Mullen had a payphone installed at the Mask.
Yeah.
So it was louder than shit.
Yeah.
You couldn't hear anything.
Yeah. Were you holding the phone up to the drummer saying, listen to this guy? Yes.
No, I found him. I found Billy. I found him. Okay, promise him anything.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out later.
Yeah. And he took it.
But Exene was already playing with us at that point.
And you guys, how did you figure out that she could sing?
She just sang.
Yeah.
Because she had heart.
Yeah.
She has heart.
And your harmonies are so specifically yours.
Yeah.
How did you guys land on that? Just by playing around with it?
Just playing. Yeah.
Man.
And I think that Exene, you know, I'll give Exene and Billy the lion's share of credit. I was, you know, I'm one of the songwriters, but I kind of collect things. I'm like the traffic director.
Right. Yeah.
I'm the traffic cop of X.
Uh-huh.
And even though, you know, I wrote some songs on my own and Exene would write songs and we would give each other credit because it was all us. And,
right.
But we just sang and she didn't know, you know, a traditional harmony. She learned it eventually. Yeah.
I don't. What is that harmony though? Because I don't know harmonies, but it's almost like it's.
She would sing a second if it felt good.
It's almost Appalachian.
Yeah, yeah. You just sing whatever fourths.
Yeah.
I think
is that what it is?
Which is usually it's like in rock and roll music, thirds and fifths.
Uh huh. So this is a little different.
But she would just hear it and she'd sing it. You know.
And when you started to really work, so it was 77. So it took like a few years to put that first record together.
We just had no place to. There was no record company.
But you were out just jamming and playing gigs every night, making the rounds,
every weekend, not every night.
Who were the guys around? Like who was around? Black Flag, the Blasters. Like who were on the bills?
No, earlier it was people like Black Randy and the Metro Squad and the Deadbeats and the Alley Cats and the Go Go's were there.
Oh yeah, Screamers, what were they like early on? Good?
Just like yeah. They couldn't play that well.
Right.
But they still had the songs and they were just, that was baffling for everybody.
What, the Go-Go's?
That they weren't, you know, signed and it didn't have a $1 million.
Because it was, you just felt it? You were like, oh my God.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
There's five girls that are adorable and they play pop music. So, are you out of your fucking mind? How far do you have your head up your ass? You can't see that. You know?
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it was pride.
Uh-huh. The record companies?
Yeah.
In what way?
We like it the way it is. Don't you kids come in here messing up our program. That was going on up until they just like collapsed.
Yeah. I guess that's true. Yeah. I'm trying to think 77, so I was in high school. So that was like fucking, what was it? Foreigner? Yeah.
I don't know. But the Go-Go's and who else? The Deadbeats and the Alley Cats and... Of course, the Germs, but the Germs really couldn't play that much because they would constantly, them or the audience would screw stuff up, would break the toilet, and then, oh, well, they can't play that gig anymore, which was fun.
Someone
broke. I personally did not pull the toilet. I think that was Black Randy. That was his trick.
What, pull the toilet out of the ground?
Yeah. With some help. You know, a couple of so this big sense of cooperation.
Early punk,
it takes a village.
LA punk, yeah, takes a village to pull
takes a
toilet.
Village. But you know, Brendan Mullen, bless his heart, rest in peace. You know, he had the mask, and he somehow convinced people for a short period of time that was okay.
Where was that place?
It was off of Cherokee.
Uh huh.
In an alley, the entrance, luckily, it was below what used to be the Pussycat Theater, which I don't know what it is now. It's still sort of a theater, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a church.
Yeah.
But, luckily the entrance was in the alley. And there was only one entrance and one exit when there were like 400 people down there.
Oh, my God.
Such a fire trap.
Yeah.
But there was rehearsal places down there. We shared one with the Go-Go's for a while. And
when did the scene really sort of take hold and start to win, you know, in the sense that
I'm not sure that it ever really did.
Yeah,
I mean it got popular through the free papers, through the LA Reader. Chris Morris was a good champion, and then Christine McKenna from the LA Times.
But when
the two of them and Slash magazine, that was a monthly free magazine. It was all about punk rock, all about the, you know, what's going on. It's under your nose. Find a band.
Right.
There's plenty of them out there.
Lock in.
The original, like, punk rock scene in L.A. was eclectic. It was the Weirdos and the Screamers and the Germs and Fear and the Controllers and the Alley Cats and the Go-Go's and, you know, it was all, like, arty and then rock and roll.
Right.
But people had cars, so there was, like, this kind of... Eddie Cochran, Chuck Berry thing,
right?
You know, in there, and it was, you know,
everyone was represented. And then I guess when the testosterone comes around, there must have been a feeling of like these were the guys that we were fighting against,
in a way.
Yeah,
you know, it was a little bit of bridge and tunnel,
right,
kind of stuff. And that was confusing. But by that time, you know, we put out Los Angeles. It was 1980. And then we were starting to go on the road. And
at that time, also, like the crew that got sort of called the roots music thing, mm-hmm. like the Blasters, Lone Justice, you guys. And I know there's a couple other ones. But I mean,
Gun Club would be included.
Yeah,
in
Gun
that.
Club.
Blood on the Saddle, mm-hmm. Tex and the Horseheads. They were a great band.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know them.
Yeah, I produced a record of theirs. They did some really great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, because like you guys had a place, and everybody seemed to have their place.
It was big enough so things could start fracturing.
So,
and there would be factions of like, there was more rockabilly, rootsy gigs.
Right.
And then there was more like badass, hardcore, punk rock gigs.
I guess
and
Los Lobos too, right?
Los Lobos were, you know, I mean, they've been playing since 76 or something like that.
What's that dude's name? He did a record. He got real strung out. He did that kind of roots music, and he's up in the Bay Area, and the guys from Los Lobos and some people.
Carlos Catarlos?
Carlos Catarlos. Are you on that record?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
What was that guy's story?
Carlos was a guy from, Glassell Park.
But he was around, right, in the 80s?
Yeah, he was from around here.
And he had a band.
Well, he and Top Jimmy
had a
band called Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Conchek was, he used to work at a place called Top Taco.
Uh-huh.
And he was going to call himself Top Taco Jimmy.
Yeah.
I said, that's a terrible name, Jimmy. How about Top Jimmy?
Yeah.
It sounds like he could be from, you know, a reggae guy.
Yeah.
But they played blues and they played great stuff. That was an awesome band. Steve Berlin from Los Lobos was in that band.
Uh-huh.
And Carlos Catarlos was a songwriter and just, he was crazy. He was just so nutty.
Yeah.
And he went up to San Francisco. But the whole time, he would have these episodes where he'd be completely out of control, and he had diabetes the whole time.
Yeah.
And it was driving him insane.
Right.
And
out of control, you know, on drugs.
Yeah.
And just mentally.
You know, do a bunch of coke and drink, you know, whiskey, and then he's big, too.
Yeah.
I can remember a guy punching him in the middle of the forehead like he would take out a cow, you
right,
know,
with
a, and he just went down straight. Backward,
yeah,
and they just came right back up.
Yeah,
it was like the Living Dead. I was like, oh, that's when like eight people grabbed him and
right.
You know, took it.
Right,
but he, you know, became a street person in San Francisco, and then everyone nursed, and he was very humbled and nursed him back to health, and
uh-huh.
And then as soon as he got healthy, he was difficult again.
Yeah,
he was really full of himself. I love Carlos, but he's such a handful.
Interesting album, man.
Yeah,
to hear that a guy with that story, you know, and like it sounds like he might have lost a couple teeth along the way.
Yep, yep. Well, check out Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs.
That's the name of that guy's band.
It's, it's called their Top Jimmy was a great singer. Carlos was just the guitar player, and he's a great guitar player.
And Jeffrey Lee was a friend of yours.
Oh yeah,
like it seemed like he had his own like weird kind of.
Demons.
Yeah, demons, but also like a kind of charm that was a little transcendent in a way.
Yes. Gift of gab, and he was really sweet and kind of helpless at times, and people wanted to, you know, take him under his wing, under their wing. And,
yeah.
And, but Jeffrey was kind of like, he kind of invented himself.
Right.
He's from, you know, the West Valley.
Yeah.
But he listened to a bunch of 78s, and he goes, I get this.
Yeah.
And I get this blues thing. And his idea of melody and hitting the right note was like from outer space.
Well, they covered that Robert Johnson tune. Was it Preach the Blues?
Preaching Blues,
great. That was great.
But Jeffrey Lee kind of invented himself. And, you know, if you do that long enough, then you become that person. And he sort of invented this persona of Jeffrey Lee Pierce, the punk rock blues man. And, you know... He took a page from the Cramps, for sure.
Uh-huh.
But he definitely brought that swampy and voodoo, you know.
Was he at odds with the character he created? Is that like
No,
what?
I think he was just, he just got sucked into
the drugs and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you, like on the first album, like why, how did, you know, Ray Manzarek get involved?
He saw us at the Whiskey. We were opening for the band called Levi and the Rock Cats.
Uh-huh.
Ray and his wife Dorothy went down there and we played Soul Kitchen because we were playing that anyway.
Yeah.
It was, you know, twice as fast. And,
right. You know, you guys do a great cover of that thing.
And Exene was singing it and Dorothy, because ladies are usually smarter than men,
yeah.
said, "Hey, Ray, they're playing your song." He said, "What?" "They are?" And then we, you know, met him that night, and it was, I don't remember it. Xane remembers it pretty well.
But yeah.
I just remember that he came to a rehearsal and I was sweating.
Yeah.
Shitting bricks. And but he seemed to like it. And that was a huge, for Xane and I especially.
Were you Doors fans?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
I used to try to sing like Jim Morrison.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, yeah, that's not, no easy trick.
Yeah. He could, he had a scream that I could never, I could croon, but I couldn't.
Oh, the scream like on the live album, like One in Five?
Oh,
yeah.
But yeah, that was a big deal for me.
And what does he bring to it? Like in your mind when you listen to that record, if the last like,
well, he played on it for one.
Yeah,
but he did the first four records because we loved him.
He did all of those.
Yep,
every one.
Yep. And then when we went away from him, we made that questionable heavy metal record with Michael Wagner called Ain't Love Grand, because we started believing our own bullshit, I think. We thought, wait a minute, everyone says we're the next big thing. Maybe it's the producer that's holding us back.
Right.
No. Anyway, what did he bring? He was a great cheerleader.
Yeah.
He knew how to give you the confidence that you might have lacked, and he would know when a take was good. So he didn't try to mess with us. And he recorded us like the Doors recorded. We just all were in a room, and then we fixed stuff that was bad. You know, we play along and then punch in and punch out and you know, fix little pieces that were bad. But it was all generally a live performance. And he also, on that first record, I think he chose the songs. Like, let's, you know, and because we had songs like Adult Books or I'm Coming Over or We're Desperate. There were more punk rock.
Yeah.
And that first record was more us.
Some of that stuff shows original. Up on that collection that I have, like some of the alternative takes and some of the unreleased stuff, right? On that, which one, Beyond and Back.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff on there that's not on the records.
Yeah.
And there's a couple on your new big collection that's unreleased stuff.
Yeah, a couple.
That you actually wrote with Xane, and it seemed like you covered them acoustic.
I did.
Yeah.
Take 52 and Poor Girl.
Yeah.
And
Poor Girl's great. I listened to that stuff last night.
Good.
Yeah. But like, okay, so let's get to the rise and fall of that, and then the solo career. Is that, what were the pressures? Because I mean, you did these like Los Angeles, Wild Gift, Under the Big Black Sun, More Fun Than New World, and those they're all great records.
Yeah.
And they all have their, you know, a couple of them have, you know, kind of hits, right?
It wasn't a matter of like getting a hit, at least for the first two songs, for
right?
First two records,
right?
We were just playing live and we were doing well.
Yeah.
And we got to tour, and actually we got, you know, really good notice in the New York Times and the LA Times, like number one record and number two record and the Village Voice Jazz. Or
for which Pat. One, Wild Gift or Los Angeles?
Both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wild Gift actually, I think was like number one in New York and LA.
So
which was like, fuck.
You
and we had no idea.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, I guess this is good. Yeah. Okay, let's go play.
Right.
What do you want to do now? It wasn't about having a hit. It was about just turning things upside down. And it was about, proving that we could actually do this and that it was that people did like it. And we played, you know, like the Greek Theater and pretty much sold it out after Wild Gift with no major record company.
Right.
You know, it's like 7,000 people.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal. And but then we signed to Elektra because we thought, well, now we can, they gave us complete artistic freedom.
You were at Slash.
Yes, we were at Slash Records. And then went to Elektra, and that was where the Doors were from. And that's where, you know, Phil Oakes was from. They were in, you know, so.
The history.
And Love
was
on Elektra.
Yeah.
And it got us around a little bit more. You know, a lot of people said, oh, yeah, the first record I knew that you had was Under the Big Black Sun.
So, right.
So that still has, they all still have relevance. And because we didn't just play punk rock. And that was, you know, like Darby would always say, you guys are a bunch of hippies. Because we play songs like, you know, Blue Spark or Adult Books or something that's slower because it wasn't all just.
Right. Do you think that was the blessing and the curse that you didn't have a, you know, like a repeatable, like it seems that what makes people popular, unfortunately, is their ability to repeat themselves over and over again.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that. I think the way we played and the subject matter was too, and the timing was all wrong, and they couldn't take advantage of a hot couple that was a, you know, it's like, what, they have two lead singers now? This I don't want to know about it. And punk rock had a terrible reputation, you know, even as late as like 84-85 we did a version of Wild Thing.
Yeah,
it sounds a lot like Joan Jett.
Right.
But it was us, and they sent it around to a bunch of classic rock stations, Elektra did, in a plain package with no credit. And they said, oh, this is great. Who is it? They say, X. And they go, oh, we can't play it.
Why?
Because it's punk rock.
So you got labeled somehow, and that was a liability?
Yeah. I mean, for us, it was a badge of honor. I mean, it was ghettoized, but, you know.
That's interesting.
It pissed us off, but whatever.
There are these lines drawn between rock and punk rock.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
That's big wild, time.
And there's a lot of revisionist history, you know, like saying that Rolling Stone really led the charge with the Ramones and stuff like that. The Ramones didn't get popular until the last, I mean, really popular until the last 2 or 3 years of their career.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were bits and pieces, you know, like Chrissy Hynde, because she had a more rock kind of thing.
Right.
You know? And Elvis Costello would break through because he was, you know, very clever and
poppy. Yeah.
And the Go-Go's, and so some of the new wave bands. But, you know, we just sang weird and whatever. Maybe that's why we still play.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's why we're not just a joke.
And you're still sort of vital. It still means something to you.
Yeah, it means something to the people that come. I mean, you sent me down to the burrito joint.
Yeah.
This kid who was like a Latino kid, probably 20.
Yeah.
Got a giant X tattoo on his shin.
Really?
He goes, dude, what are you doing in the neighborhood? I said, well, I'm just getting a burrito, and there's this guy, I'm doing a podcast. No shit. Wow, yeah. That's cool. Man, I got a band, it's called The Goons. Yeah. So I think his name was Odie.
Yeah.
Odie and the Goons, man.
That's got to mean
something. Keep it real. Here on York.
That's got to mean something, though.
I mean, hell yeah.
I mean, that's a lasting thing, man.
It is on his leg.
Yeah.
No, I do. I'm totally grateful, and I honor that.
It means you invented something that has a life, you know, transcendent of anything of time.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, you know, someone saying like, oh, you want to know what punk is, you want to know what music is, go listen to X.
Yeah.
You're like that.
That's one kind of punk rock.
Right. But that's the cool thing. You set a thing. You set a standard. Yes.
That's a cool thing about what L.A. had and what New York had, is that it wasn't all the same.
Right.
And that's where it's gone a little bit wrong. And I do love Green Day. I think they, you know, brought it to the audience that needed to hear it. You know,
right.
The like 15 and 16 year olds.
Right.
And Billy Joe is kind of a friend of mine, and I he's their band. It's great. However, it became a much narrower definition, because Blondie, Talking Heads, the Ramones, Richard Hell, Heartbreak, they're all different.
Oh yeah.
You know, and all the bands that were in LA, they're all different.
Yeah.
But then it got a little narrower. It became a little narrower.
It became sort of a caricature of itself in a way.
Yeah, I don't know what you want. That's, yeah.
Like, it landed on this one thing. It's sort of British poppy pace thing. It didn't have any range to it.
Yeah.
Like, even like the Dead Boys and, like, you know, things, the Dolls, which was a little before that, it allowed it to get weird, and everyone was sort of accepting. It was a community of weirdos.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of narrowed into this one sound.
Yeah, well.
You can hear it in the drums right away. I get records all the time, and I put it on. It's okay, here we go. Exactly. They think they got the punk rock going.
Hey, you guys play so fast.
Yeah. So how did you, what led to the sort of breaking apart of the band?
Well, opportunities.
Yeah.
Geffen Records waved a bunch of money in my face and said, you want to make a solo record? And I said, sure. But that doesn't mean that X was done.
Right.
Because I could do both. And then Tony Gilkison, Dave Alvin played in the band for a little while, and then Tony Gilkison played with us for many years.
Yeah.
And then in 99, Billy said, well, what if we did some more stuff?
Yeah.
Because we were doing that Elektra compilation.
Yeah.
And we said, sure. And then we played the Palladium, and it was awesome and fun. And when we first started rehearsing, it was like it just clicked. It was like we never stopped playing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Now we're trying something different. We're doing it like a quieter but trying to be as intense.
And what's the lineup now?
It's the same.
Yeah.
Last punk rock band standing.
Yeah.
Billy, DJ, and Xene, and John.
That's unbelievable.
You're telling me, brother. But, you know, we buried a lot of, you know, buried a lot of our bullshit and acceptance and you know, I love those. Age, yeah.
You guys are survivors.
Yeah.
I got to imagine some of this shit's not as important as it used to be.
Right. Yeah. It's not.
What were you going to say? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay. Things are not as important. You learn to forgive people and just accept them as who they are.
What was the biggest sticking point? I mean, what was like the hardest thing?
I have no idea. Probably that they thought I was a you know, controlling asshole, which I guess I was at times. And I still am.
Yeah.
I still like to take charge and whatever. But.
Who's that guy you work with on the solo stuff, that guitar player?
Smokey Hormel.
I didn't know him until I started listening to you, and I was like, how did I not know this guy? He's great.
He's terrific. He plays with everybody.
Yeah.
He's playing with Beck now.
Where did he come from?
He was around here, actually. Smokey bought Billy's other really fucking loud amp. the Fender concert amp that Billy hopped up. Billy is an electronics genius.
Oh, he is.
And he can take a car engine apart.
Yeah.
And put it back together and run better.
Oh, right.
He's built he was doing studio repairs before he, you know, got busy with X back in the, you know, mid 70s.
Didn't he have some other business going for a while?
He still does.
What is it?
I don't know, Zoom Industries or something like that.
I can't remember what it was.
Billy Zoom Music. But he builds this incredible reverb and reverb, he would correct me, reverb,
because
it's reverberation,
right?
But it's a standalone unit, and you plug it into there, and then you go into the amp, and it's like, it's got all these different crazy things, and it's all analog shit, and it's great.
And you guys are all together, and you're playing. Yeah. Now we're playing
like we're taking down the decibels.
Yeah.
So when we do the Christmas shows around here in December, it's like the X folk show. It's kind of crazy. I was really reluctant. I thought, what are you fucking nuts?
Yeah.
You're going to take away some of the speed and the volume? This is insane.
Yeah.
And Billy said, nope, this is the way it's going to be.
Uh-huh.
And Xene said, yep, I'm with him. And I was like, okay, I guess I'm with you guys. But it's really fun. It's like much more musical.
And who do you see when you look out in the audience, usually?
Young people.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's amazing, man.
Yeah, I know. It's really rewarding.
And they dig it?
Oh, of course they do.
That's great.
Yeah.
But like the solo career, I mean, like when I got the collection in the mail, you know, I remember buying Meet John Doe, and I remember one of the other ones, but like you just kept going, man.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's why I did the best of.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you didn't say greatest hits, because there are no hits.
Right, but
no hits.
Well, I was gonna ask you how
there could have been. But they weren't. Anyway.
How did you go about selecting that? I mean, you're sitting down with a catalog of work. Who'd you sit with to make those decisions?
Myself and my sweetheart, like a smart person, a smart man.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I did most of it. And then I asked Dave Way, who's recorded most of them. He's a great producer and engineer.
Yeah.
He did a lot of Macy Gray's stuff.
Uh-huh.
Early Macy Gray stuff and some Ringo Starr and all kinds of cool stuff. Talked to him. I talked to, you know, a few other friends and just said, well, I like this one and I like that one. And that's, I felt was better and no one really noticed it. So let's try that one. And then my sweetheart would say, well, don't forget that one. And I said, oh yeah, that's good.
Yeah, let's get that one.
I did it because, I had more, solo records than X records.
Right.
And I thought, well, shit.
Yeah. It's interesting that all the, you know, when I started reading lyrics, I'm not fundamentally a lyric-driven person. I like reading poetry, but I like music. I like listening to riffs.
Yeah.
And it's all really poetry still with you.
Well, shucks. Thanks.
I mean, how does that process work for you? I mean, you don't come up with a melody first. You write those words, right?
Sometimes I'll just sing along with a melody, and I'll make it up as I go.
Uh-huh.
But then the poet kind of kicks in and does the editing and changes little words and messes around with it. But I try not to be too intellectual about it.
Right, right.
That'll kill it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll just have a bunch of words, like the stuff that I still write with Xene. She'll just give me a song that's like top to bottom. It's a song.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you do that? You just like four lines, and then there's a little two line in between, and then it goes into a chorus. Wow, you just wrote that from the beginning to the end.
It's good that you still respect each other.
Oh God, yeah.
It's great. It's good to hear. And then the acting career. I mean, Jesus, man. I knew you were in a few movies. I remember seeing you, but you've done like 50, 60 movies. Yeah, it's crazy.
A little here and there.
But I mean, how do you get movies? You got an agent, obviously. But
I didn't used to. I just recently did.
So people are like, let's get John Doe to do this.
Let's get John Doe to play a musician.
No, but you played a shitty dad once, didn't you? I can't remember vaguely or something. And
played a shitty cop, shitty dad, shitty shitty everything. Because that dark side, it never goes away.
Yeah, yeah. He brings the darkness. But are you sober?
No.
No?
But I don't do drugs. And I'll drink responsibly.
Yeah.
Like 90% of the time.
Right. So you were just a lucky one. You just leveled off.
Yeah.
You aged out.
I aged out, but I keep thinking about quitting the drink.
Yeah,
I still might. I think it might clear my head.
Yeah,
that's what they say. But you know, I don't know.
Tomorrow, man.
Tomorrow, yeah, maybe tomorrow.
Why don't you kick tomorrow?
Frankly, that was a song.
Sure
I'll
was.
I'll quit tomorrow. Yes, that was a Tex and the Horsehead song.
Oh, really?
You're gonna have to look it up. I'll quit tomorrow.
So you like acting?
Sure, it's you know, it's another creative thing, and the best part is doing the research to figure out who the character is, and I take it real seriously, but I will never say the work.
Yeah, right.
I don't take it like that seriously, but I did some, you know, did some scene study and some improv and some stuff like that.
So you did when in the history of X were you doing scene study and improv?
When we weren't touring.
Oh, so you were actually kind of like
here in LA.
This. Yeah.
Well, I did a movie with Harry Dean Stanton called Slam Dance, and Tom Hulse was in it, and so was Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and Virginia Madsen, and anyway, Harry Dean and I were cops, like homicide cops, and I was the dirty cop, and he was the good cop, and we would do these scenes, and I would realize as we're doing it, holy shit, I'm getting left in the dust. I am barely keeping up with this guy. This guy is fucking burying me.
Yeah, he's a Zen master, man.
He's, you know, and he wasn't doing anything.
Right. That's what makes him amazing.
I'm like, God damn. And so I thought, I don't want to embarrass myself.
Right.
Because this is going to be like a 9 foot high embarrassment. It's going to be a giant, like, I can see that.
Yeah, yeah.
I can see that you suck.
Yeah.
And I don't, I'm obviously not great.
Yeah, but I can you do can some show stuff up and do it. Yeah,
you know, well, I did the most recent one I did was called Pleased to Meet Me, and that was really fun. It was a super fast independent movie with Amy Mann and and Loudon Wainwright and Joe Henry.
That's a bunch of musicians,
and,
huh?
Yeah,
yeah.
And it was really fun.
Oh, who shot that movie?
This guy named Archie Borders did it in Louisville, Kentucky. You know, got a bunch of independent investors, and it's on, you know, video on demand and Blu-ray and all that bullshit.
I like Amy. I know Amy.
Amy's awesome.
She is amazing, huh?
Yeah, she's funny.
Yeah.
She's funny and dark and sweet and
solid musician.
Oh yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, she's scary how good she plays.
It's wild, man. Like it's all you guys. Like I'm always amazed because I get people in here.
Now she's smart. When you look at her lyrics, you go like, "How did you use some $50 word and make it sound normal?" Damn.
But she's also like, she's different than us in that, and I'm just putting myself into this crew. Like, she's not a chaos person, man. I mean, she's a, you know, she can control the environment. You know, everything's going to be tight. You know what I mean?
I'm glad that you included me in your chaos team.
Well, am I wrong?
No, you're totally right. I'm glad. I'm glad I'm part of the
team chaos,
let's
baby.
Fuck shit up.
Yeah. You want to play one?
Yeah, I don't know what to play, but let's figure it out. This is the only song that I've composed that I could say is sort of a John Doe hit.
Okay.
This is the closest that I've gotten.
Okay.
You are the hole in my head. I am the pain in your neck. You are
lump in my throat. I am on the tip of your tongue. We are tangled, we are stolen, we are living where things are hidden. You are something in my eye. I am the shiver down your spine, and you are the lick of my lips. I am on the tip of your tongue. We are tangled, we are stolen, we are buried up to our necks in sand. We're luck, we're fate, we are the feeling you get in the golden state. We are love, we are hate, we are the feeling I get when you walk away. Dream in my nightmare, I am that falling sensation. You are my needles and pins. I am your hang of the morning. We are tangled, we are stolen, we are living where things are hidden. We are luck, we are fate, we are the feeling you get in the golden state. We are love, we are hate, we are the feeling I get when you walk away, walk away, walk away. You are in my head, I am the pain in your neck. You are the lump in my throat. I am the aching in your heart.
That was great, man. I really appreciate you coming.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing it.
My pleasure.
All right, that's it. That's our show. John Doe, thank you for being here. If you're listening, good talk. Thanks again to our sponsor, A24, and their new film, While We're Young, a comedy from writer-director Noah Baumbach. Also, go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get the app. Get some justcoffee.coop. Get on the mailing list. God knows I go out of my way to mail you something every week. Do what you're going to do. Boomer lives! Three chords, man. Three chords.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.